Harry Sr. had gone on to found the New Buddles Boxing Gym in a notoriously downtrodden area of town, to give the men who had lost their livelihoods a healthy escape. It had since become an institution in its own right under his son's careful management, and its doors stood open to men and women from all walks of life. But its main clientele was, and always would be, men and boys from the local community. And, as Phillips was aware, some of them made their living operating on the wrong side of the law. What he intended to find out was whether any of them were involved in Edward's escape. Evening, Harry. He accepted one of the worn oak chairs sitting at right angles to a basic desk pushed against one wall. Behind it, there was a long window looking out into the gym area, so that Harry could keep an eye on things. "Heard you went around or two yesterday," Harry said, reaching for a cup of herbal tea resting on the edge of the desk. He held it up and grunted, which Phillips understood to be an invitation to have a cup himself. He waved it away.
I came in on Monday morning," Phillips replied, not wanting to rehash it.
"Felt better after." Harry grunted again and took another slurp of his lemon and ginger tea. "What brings you back so soon, if it's not to put a pair of gloves on?"
Phillips swiped a hand across his face and looked away, then back again.
"Look, Harry. We've known each other for, what? 50 years.
"Must be something like that," the other agreed, waiting to see where the conversation was headed.
"Used to spark you out, even back then." He grinned, showing a mouthful of bright white caps.
"In all that time, you know I've never bothered with the odd bit of funny business going on in this place."
"Wait a minute. Hear me out, Harry." Phillips overrode the automatic defense because they both knew the score. "I loved coming here when it was your dad at the helm, and I've missed coming back more often. You've got a good, solid thing going here, and some of the lads have gone on to do great things."
Harry smiled proudly because it was true. Ryan had worried about a lack of safety measures when he'd seen Phillips punching the living daylights out of the punters, but that wasn't the norm under Harry's watch. He'd made an exception for his boyhood friend, but anybody else who had stormed into his gym demanding a fight without headwear or mouth guards would have been kicked out.
"For all that, we both know that a lot of traffic comes through these doors and not all of it is law-abiding."
Harry said nothing but lifted the mug to his lips again.
"I pick my battles," Phillips went on, looking him dead in the eye. "And, God knows, I've no wish to start a battle with you. But, so help me, I mean to find out who financed the man who's taken Denise."
Harry listened with a sinking heart, hearing the note of desperation in Frank's voice. A desperate man would stop at nothing until he got what he wanted, but there were other things to consider. Important things that could cost lives. He looked out into the gym, watched a pair of young lads sparring, and when he looked back into Frank's tired brown eyes, he remembered when they had been youngsters together, picking fights on street corners just for the fun of it.
"All right, Frank," he said, and reached across to flip the blind down. It fell in a heap of clattering plastic against the window frame and they were enclosed for a moment, just two old friends.
"But this didn't come from me. Understand?"
Phillips nodded.
"One of my lads sometimes drains the blokes who come in for a white-collar fight. Makes them feel better about themselves when they're stuck behind a desk playing with spreadsheets." He let out a short, rumbling laugh. "Takes all sorts. Anyway, they stick with the same trainer for 6 months ahead of the fight, but, about a week ago,
some chump comes into the gym asking for a new trainer because his old one has buggered off. My lad agreed to step in, and that's how they got chatting.
Go on, Phillips urged. As I say, these two got chatting over the past week, and it turns out this toff's old training partner disappeared without so much as a by your leave.
I thought nothing of it, Harry shrugged. Until, the very next day, I hear one of the other lads talking about a job opening down at the All-American Diner.
That's Moffa's place.
I know it, Phillips growled, as the pieces began to fall neatly into place. The Moffa family was one of the notorious gangland families written in bold blue ink on his notepad. Originally from Manchester, the three brothers had migrated further north to claim their own patch of turf. Considering there were older, more established claims to the lucrative drugs industry in Newcastle, it was a testament to their innovative methods that they had been able to muscle their way in. The All-American Diner was a trendy, all-day hotspot near the railway station in Newcastle, decked out to look like the set of Pulp Fiction with a long bar, red leather booths, a checkered dance floor and an enormous Cadillac in the middle of it all. Behind all that, Jimmy the Mank Moffa kept his office, both literally and figuratively. Phillips turned his attention back to Harry, who continued his story. Well, you probably know the lad wasn't talking about a job opening as a waiter. One of Moffa's best men has gone all, and that means there's an opening in the firm.
Who's left, and is he still alive?
Harry scratched the side of his bulbous nose. Couldn't tell you whether he's alive and kicking on the Costa Brava or whether he's making friends with the fish at the bottom of the river. But his name was something weird, he muttered. Made me think of a board game.
Like Cluedo? Phillips offered, without needing to rack his brain.
Aye, that's the one. It rhymed with that, I reckon.
Ludo, Phillips said.
Moffa's right-hand man is called Ludo, on account of his close and personal relationship with Quaaludes back in the day.
I remember him, now, Harry nodded.
Big lad, built like a brick shit house, pockmarked face.
That's him.
It was little wonder that Helen Hayworth had been too frightened to describe the man who had abducted her. She would have known that he was so physically distinctive that any police officer within four county command areas would have identified him immediately and, in doing so, would have signed her own death warrant.
Phillips found that he was now faced with a new dilemma. He had a solid suspect, but doing anything about it might endanger a young family.
But doing nothing would endanger Denise. He rose from his chair and held out a grateful hand to his old friend. Ryan tried calling Phillips' mobile for the 10th time and, when it went straight to voicemail, he swore loudly and to nobody in particular. Anna raised tired eyes from her own laptop computer and took that as her cue to shut it down for the day.
I don't have time to be running around looking for him, Ryan said, tersely.
We've got enough on our hands trying to hunt down a murderer before he kills again.
I'd have thought Phillips would want to pitch in, instead of disappearing off into the night.
Anna hitched herself up onto the edge of his desk and crossed her ankles, letting him rant.
Perhaps he's found a new lead, she suggested.
If he had, you'd think he would damn well share it with the rest of us, Ryan bit out.
Now isn't the time to be galloping off, playing the hero.
You'd never do a thing like that, Anna said, ever so smoothly.
Ryan's next words died on his tongue and he sent her a withering look, which slid like water off a duck's back.
Those were very different circumstances, he argued. going after the people who endangered my life, Anna mused. Yes, I can see how that's different to Philip's situation. There's no need to be sarcastic. Then climb down from your high horse, detective, she shot back. You're the boss, but this is Frank's city. He knows it, and he's probably speaking to other people who know it, too. He gave her a searching look. What did he tell you? Now, don't get mad. Ryan's eyes darkened to an ominous, stormy gray. Anna. All right, don't shoot the messenger, she held out both hands in appeal. He asked me not to mention it for an hour or so because he had a couple of things he wanted to take care of alone. He said he was heading out to speak to some old friends but he'd be back by 9:30. Ryan looked again at the clock and saw that it read 21:20. Why didn't he want me with him? He asked, and Anna was sorry to see a flicker of hurt in his eyes. I would have gone with him, anywhere he needed. Does he think I'm a liability after what happened this afternoon? I'm sure he doesn't think anything like that, she tried to reassure him. Frank knows that this afternoon was a one-off and nobody could blame you for it. I'm sure there's another explanation. But Ryan looked unconvinced. I hope he knows what he's doing, was all he said. Chapter 14. Philip sat in his car for a while after leaving Buddles, considering what was the right and proper thing to do. He was in a quandary, one half of him bound in conscience to a family who had not asked to be part of the hacker's evil game, the other half bound in love to the woman who had come to mean everything to him. Eventually, he settled on a course of action that would satisfy both sides. He fiddled with his smartphone and forwarded an email to D.I. Rogers over at Durham Sid with an attached image of Paul Evershet, the man known more commonly as Ludo, taken from his police file. He typed only one request, which was that Rogers show the photo to Helen Hayworth and watch for her reaction. After his phone made a tinkling sound to signify that the email had sent, Phillips ignored the red notifications telling him Ryan had been trying to get in touch and turned his phone off. He started the car engine and steered it back towards the center of town, slowing as he passed the house that he had grown up in. There were net curtains in the windows, which was something, but the front door had a scrap of plywood nailed across it following an attempted break-in. He felt a weight of sadness settle on his chest, but he shoved it to one side and accelerated through the darkened streets. It wasn't his home anymore. Back in the center of town, the All-American Diner was busy, even for a Tuesday night. Waitresses dressed in candy stripper uniforms buzzed from table to table, and men dressed to look like John Travolta flipped cocktails behind the bar. Groups of 20-somethings laughed, enjoying the kitsch feel to the place with none of the discomfort that came from knowing how it managed to stay in business while so many other new bars and restaurants dropped like flies in the overcrowded market. The diner managed to affect a cheerful atmosphere thanks to its bold color scheme and classic power tunes pumping out of the jukebox in the corner, but Phillips hated everything about it. It was a curse of being in his line of work, he supposed, but with his trained eye, he was able to see beyond all the gloss, stripping it away to uncover what was buried beneath the surface. And what he saw was a brawny bouncer with bloodshot eyes thanks to a reliance on cocaine and a generous helping of steroids, a bar-restaurant fronted by unscrupulous men, and an awful lot of pink. As he approached the doors, the bouncer began speaking into a microphone at the lapel of his cheap black suit. Phillips gave him an easygoing smile. All right, lad. I was just after a quick pint and a burger. Is there a problem? He couldn't have been more than 30, Phillips thought, and his face was too smooth, too clean to have had much experience. He was just muscle, intended to intimidate the weak. "We're closing." Phillips stood on his toes to look over the man's shoulder at the bustling crowd beyond and gave him a disbelieving look. "Doesn't look that way to me, son." The bouncer took a menacing step forward and grabbed hold of Phillips' jacket, thrusting him away from the door so hard that he stumbled and hit his head against the door frame. "Bugger off home, pig," he spat. "You're not welcome here." Phillips brushed a hand over his jacket to set it right again, checked his tie, then gave the man a disapproving, fatherly look. "If there's one thing I can't abide, it's rudeness," he said, before planting his fist in the man's face. The bouncer crumpled to the floor, unconscious. Phillips rubbed at his knuckle, stepped around the man's bulk and headed inside the diner, ignoring the shocked faces of nearby staff who ran to the telephone, presumably to call the police. Phillips set his jaw and decided to worry about that small complication later. Phillips knew exactly which door led to the executive offices of Jimmy Moffa, having had the misfortune of visiting the man on several occasions, always in connection with serious crimes. When you were party to as many shady deals as Jimmy, you could expect regular visits from the police. Phillips ignored the shouts from one of the barmen and tugged open the side door, which led to a long corridor painted in a tacky shade of red. At the end, a young man was guarding Jimmy's office, wearing a brand new black suit with his hair brushed back from a boyish face. He had a wiry, muscular physique which seemed to tense as Phillips stomped down the corridor towards him. "Tony, what would Yoda say if he could see you now?" The younger man shriveled inside his suit. "Or, Howie, Frank. I'm just filling in for a while, that's all." Phillips gave him a beady-eyed glare. "Aye, that's what they all say in the beginning. Stand aside, son, this doesn't concern you." "Frank, you know I don't want to get into anything with you, but—" Phillips continued to stare him down. "I can't let you in," he finished, lamely. Phillips watched the young man's eyes flicking upward and to the right. He repeated the action two more times and he realized that there must be a camera watching their every move. "I understand what you're telling me," Phillips said, then shifted his feet to give the man time to prepare himself. A moment later, Tony gave an almost imperceptible nod and Phillips swung the first blow. There followed a scuffle between the pair of them that any thespian would have been proud of, and after they both felt that a sufficient effort had been made to bar Phillips' entry, Tony fell against the wall. "Thanks, lad." Phillips gave him a wink and pushed open the door to Moffa's inner sanctum. Jimmy Moffa watched the altercation from the comfort of his enormous leather desk chair via a live CCTV feed linked to the gigantic flat-screen television dominating one wall of his office. In fact, the entire room was modeled on a Vegas hotel suite, from its monochrome color scheme to the expensive photographic prints blown up on large canvases dotted around its walls. Top-of-the-range technology was everywhere, vying for attention with expensive antiques chosen to give the impression of affluence rather than good taste. Amid all the glitz, it was easy to miss the man sitting behind the supersized black desk in the center of it all. The youngest of the three Moffa brothers was, at first glance, an average-looking man in his early 30s. He wore an expertly tailored suit of fine charcoal gray with a crisp white shirt and a fashionably skinny tie. At his cuffs,
He wore a pair of diamond-encrusted cufflinks to match the stud winking in his right earlobe and the Cartier watch on his left wrist. His hair was closely shaven, drawing more attention to his face, which was a mixture of sharp cheekbones and the palest blue eyes Phillips had ever seen. When Phillips entered, he was waiting for him with a mobile phone in his hand, poised to dial. "Well, if it isn't Scrappy Doo," he rasped. "Have you lost your way?" Phillips stayed near the door but faced him down. "I've got plenty of bite left in me yet, especially for a common little prick like you." Moffa bared his teeth in the semblance of a smile. "Big talk, old man. You might have caught the bouncers off guard, but you'll not have the same luck with me, so watch your step." He jiggled the mobile phone he held in his hand. "Guess who I'm about to call? Your mum?" Phillips happened to know that Moffa's mother had died after an accidental overdose and, sure enough, a dark red flush of anger crept along the man's neck and he thrust upward to slap both hands on his desk. "You'd better turn around and walk back out of that door before I lose my temper," he snarled. "Remind me to shit my pants later," Phillips shot back. "In the meantime, I want to know where he is." Something like surprise flickered across Moffa's face, quickly masked. "Who? Your boss? Maybe you should try looking in the loony bin." His laugh was gleeful. "I heard the big man took a right funny turn earlier today. And there must be a rat in the department who told him all about it," Phillips thought, but that was a problem for another day. "You know exactly who I'm talking about. Ear Edwards." Moffa walked around to the front of his desk and pressed dial on his mobile phone. "Let's put this on speakerphone," he said. The ringing tone was replaced by a click and then an operator's voice, asking which emergency service he required. "Police," Moffa gasped, theatrically. "I've been attacked. He's gone mad, attacking everyone. Come quickly." He turned and threw the mobile into the corner of the office, where it smashed against a crystal decanter laid out for his more discerning guests. Phillips looked on aghast as Moffa strolled around to the other side of his desk and swept the contents onto the floor. His laptop fell with a crash, followed by several heavy desk ornaments. As a final piece de resistance, he selected a large crystal tumbler which had partially broken against the polished floor and brandished it in front of Phillips. "What there?" Moffa merely laughed. "Now for my final trick, ladies and gents." He crossed the room and Phillips braced himself for a confrontation, fists clenched and ready to throw the first punch. But Moffa took him by surprise. He grasped one of Phillips' fists, shoving the broken tumbler hard into his palm and driving the jagged edge of glass into his skin. Phillips cried out as Moffa continued to crush the glass against his palm, then suddenly he withdrew it. Phillips realized then what he planned to do and tried to make a grab for the glass, but Jimmy had been born on the same kind of streets as him and knew all the right moves. "You're fucked, mate," he spat, and brought the glass down hard against the side of his own head, once, then twice. The third time, he brought it down hard enough to dig an inch-long cut into his own scalp. Phillips watched in horror as blood began to trickle from Jimmy Moffa's skull and, behind him, there came the sound of running footsteps down the corridor as the local police arrived. Raw, helpless anger rushed through Phillips' system as he looked into the smug, self-satisfied face of the man who had been responsible for hurting so many people.
Don't you ever feel it? He whispered. Moffa frowned his confusion. Feel what? The door burst open behind them and all of a sudden the room was filled with voices. Ryan ruminated on what could have taken Phillips away from the immediate task of following the leads generated by Beth Finnegan's murder. It was probable that they would be able to trace Edward's new vehicle and, after that, there would be every chance they could track his movements. Then again, they might not. He let out a long sigh and felt a pair of slim arms wrap around his neck. Stop worrying, Anna said, then yawned until her jaw cracked. You need some sleep, he said. We all do. It doesn't matter. I've sorted out a new place for us, just for the next few days. It's a holiday rental, so we can pick up the keys whenever it suits. Where? A little village called Blankland, she said, pulling up a chair beside him. I know it, he said. It's over in the North Pennines, off the A68 west of Durham. It's a bit rural, don't you think? It's equidistant to Durham and Newcastle, she explained. Your investigation seems to be split between both cities, so I thought it would make sense to choose somewhere in the middle. It's off the beaten track and not an obvious choice for anybody trying to find us. Which makes it safer, he finished for her. Yep. I like it, he said succinctly. It comes with a small addition to the property spec, she added, and Ryan's eyes brightened. A hot tub? Ah, no, sadly not. It comes with Phillips, since I asked him to come and stay with us. Ryan pulled her around so he could look at her. Thank you, he said quietly. It's a kind thought, except that he appears to have done a runner. Anna pulled a face. I'm surprised he isn't back by now, she admitted. I wonder what's keeping him. Just then, Ryan's mobile phone began to vibrate and he slapped his hands against his pockets until he realized it was sitting in his direct eye line, on top of his desk. Ryan. Anna watched his face transform into a forbidding expression. Right. No, don't do that, I'll come and pick him up. He jabbed a finger to end the call. Damn. What is it? She asked worriedly. What's happened? It's Frank. He's been taken into custody for GBH on Jimmy Moffa. They've got him inside a squad car parked outside the All-American Diner. I don't believe it, she whispered. What on earth was he doing there? Ryan shrugged into his jacket and waved goodbye to any prospect of sleep in the near future. That's a very good question. He started to make for the door, stopped, then doubled back to bestow a lingering kiss. Don't go anywhere, he said. There'll be staff on site here throughout the night, I'll be back as soon as I can. She watched his long legs eat up the floor and a moment later he was gone. Chapter 15. Edwards looked inside the room where Mackenzie slept soundly and was satisfied that the barbiturates he'd sprinkled into her water had served their purpose. She was in no fit state to run very far, but the sedative would serve as an added precaution. So peaceful, he thought. He stared at her for a while and felt lethal, like a cock trifle ready to discharge. His hands began to shake with the effort of holding back, when he could so easily see her blood soaking into the mattress as life drained from her body. No, he warned himself, Not yet. He forced himself back from the brink, but it left him feeling restless and dissatisfied. It would be imprudent to kill another one tonight because the streets would be rife with uniforms and they'd likely trace the car soon enough and start making connections. Even the mentally challenged rejects down at Northumbria Sid would eventually begin to add the corresponding numbers together to make four. Which was why he needed to tie up some loose ends tonight. But not before making a quick search of Mackenzie's bedroom. There weren't many places to hide weapons in the barren space, but he expected her to be resourceful. She had tried stabbing him, knocking him out and running away, none of which had worked so far. That didn't mean she had given up trying to find new, increasingly innovative ways to escape, not that he minded that. If it came to it, he much preferred his targets to make him give chase, because there was nothing remotely exciting about having one's prey already cooped up and ready to eat. Aha. When he dipped his head to look beneath the bed, he was amused to find a rudimentary splint, consisting of strips of wood held together by the stained elastic covering torn from the edge of the mattress. He held it up and assumed she used it to support her broken ribs. They were probably painful, he thought, without much interest. Should he confiscate the splint? She should know better than to try to cheat him, but perhaps it would be more diverting to let her go on believing that she had outwitted him. He left her sleeping and headed out into the silent night, to hunt. Jimmy Moffa wore the most elaborate head bandage Ryan had seen since he had visited the Ancient Egypt exhibition at the British Museum a few years ago. The man could give King Tut a run for his money, judging by the yards of clinical strapping tape wound around his head, no doubt to ham up the extent of his injuries. Ryan drove the car slowly past the entrance and watched in utter dismay as Moffa was led from the All-American diner by his greasy solicitor, who had probably hot-footed it down there faster than you could say ambulance chaser. Bloody hell, Ryan muttered, as he recognized two local news hacks running up the street with hungry looks in their eyes. That's all we need. Lowison grunted his agreement from the passenger seat of Ryan's car and glumly observed another local patrol car arriving, alongside more passers-by and media. What was Frank thinking, coming down here on his own? Ryan gave up trying to find a legal parking space and swerved up onto the pavement, flipping on his hazard lights. God only knows, he replied, as they opened their doors and made for the circus developing nearby. He must think that Moffu is responsible for backing Edward's escape. I thought the Hayworths refused to confirm or deny who threatened them, Lowison panted a little, trying to keep up with Ryan's long strides as they rounded the corner. That's right. But Phillips went off and did his own detective work this evening, and something obviously turned up to lead him down here. He should have come to us, rather than charging in like a bull in a china shop. Ryan stopped just before they turned the corner and gave Lowison a hard stare. I seem to remember a time, not so long ago, when you went into a dangerous situation guns blazing and without proper backup. You were in a coma for months afterward, but nobody crowed about it when you woke up. We were all happy to have you back because that's all that mattered. Lowison had the grace to look away. We're only human, Jack, especially where our loved ones are concerned. Just remember that. Lowison found himself talking to Ryan's back because a moment later he was striding off again to face down the people who sought to tear down everything he had built. Chief Inspector Ryan. He ignored the jostles and shouts from the local media, blinking as a camera flashed in his face. In reflex, He swiped out a hand and managed to snag its strap from the intrepid reporter's neck, where it fell to the concrete floor and shattered.
Hey. That's private property.
Ryan stared down his nose and smiled wolfishly.
Oops, he said. He ignored the stream of verbal abuse which followed and barged his way through the crowd until he found the blue and white police barrier, behind which there stood a young and slightly harried-looking police constable from Thailand Ware Area Command.
Ryan produced his warrant card and checked that Lowison had caught him up.
DCI Ryan and DC Lowison, Northumbria Sid, he said, dipping beneath the barrier.
Where's your commanding officer?
The constable pointed them inside the diner, where they found a woman they recognized as one of the local sergeants talking to a thick-skulled bouncer with another enormous bandage hanging from the side of his face.
He was totally out of control, they heard him say.
Turned up at the door effin' and blindin', proper rude-like, all up in my face.
Do you remember precisely what was said?
The bouncer nodded vigorously.
Aye, no bother.
Well, I said something like, good evening, sir, and he started ranting and raving. Called me a twat, or something like that, his eyes frittered away, up and to the left while he fabricated the next part of the story. I tried to be polite, right. And I told him he sounded drunk and should probably head home, like.
Ah, she said, making a cursory note on her pad.
Then what?
He just came for me, like, out of nowhere.
Just thumped the side of my head and left me for dead, the bouncer finished, with dramatic effect.
Ryan waited until the man loped off before cornering the sergeant.
D.S. Thomas?
She turned to him with tired brown eyes, which brightened immeasurably when she spotted who had arrived.
Lowison watched her reaction with long-suffering acceptance and thought that, if he didn't like the man so much, he might resent being consigned to the role of Ryan's less attractive wingman. Some of his colleagues had begun to call it the Ryan effect, but the man himself seemed totally unaware of the impact he had on people, which was probably for the best.
Yes.
And your DCI Ryan, she held out a hand and wished she'd had time to run a brush through her hair.
What happened here?
All I've heard is my sergeant was involved in some kind of minor incident.
She snorted inelegantly.
I don't know where you got your information, but it's not minor from where I'm standing. I've got 4 waiting staff and over 20 diners who confirm that your pal forced his way inside after flooring that hapless-looking bloke back there. She nodded towards the bouncer who was now talking to Moffa, bowing his head like a Labrador about to have his belly rubbed.
He must have been provoked, Ryan insisted, raking his gaze over them both with contempt.
Phillips admits to knocking him unconscious after being denied entry, she said, in a tone that invited him to argue at his peril.
Ryan's lips firmed.
He must have had a good reason.
That's not for me to say, she pointed out, fairly.
I know one thing for certain. Phillips is never, ever drunk on the job, so that bouncer is full of it.
D.S. Thomas told herself to remain patient in the face of 6 feet 2 inches of angry male, particularly one used to being in command.
I already know your sergeant is sober, she was casual, but firm.
Do you think I came in on the banana boat?
We breathalyzed him early doors, and there wasn't so much as a whiff of booze.
Ryan was relieved to hear it.
All right.
What's Moffa's valuable contribution to all this?
She smiled, appreciating his humor. He claims that Phillips accosted the doorman outside his office and then entered shortly afterward, threatening to inflict bodily harm if he didn't admit to being involved in the escape of Geir Edwards and abduction of D.I. McKenzie. Which Moffa denies? Loesen asked, and she nodded profusely. He claims that Phillips is a man on the edge and was seeking revenge for perceived injustices of the past. He's a cool one, she added, thinking of those unnerving blue eyes. Moffa says he told Phillips outright he wasn't involved and advised him to go home to sleep it off, otherwise he would call the police. He says Phillips just lunged for him, upset the desk and hit him around the head with a glass tumbler. Frank wouldn't do that, Loesen burst out. Thomas shrugged. Phillips has a bloody hand which he admits came from cutting it on the same glass tumbler, but he says Moffa forced the glass into his hand and then used it to whack himself around the head. Sounds far-fetched, if you ask me, she finished. If he says that's what happened, then it did, Ryan retorted. We'll check out the swabs, any CCTV, and piece things together. I'm giving you my word, Ryan said quietly, and she had to admit his voice was compelling. There's another side to this. The CCTV will show who threw the first punch, I'm sure of it. She swallowed. Look, I've told you we'll be looking at any footage. Until then, all I have is one hell of a spectacle, which it's getting bigger all the time. They followed the direction of her gaze and watched as Jimmy Moffa was led, hobbling and clutching at his bandage for the benefit of the paparazzi, towards a black Porsche Cayenne. Ryan's whipped back around. You're letting him go? D.S. Thomas gave him a warning look. I've taken a statement from Mr. Moffa and he has seen a medic. He's free to go home, subject to his voluntary attendance at an interview tomorrow morning. If you want to speak to his solicitor, he's still hanging around somewhere. Ryan wished it didn't sound so damn reasonable. Where? She scanned the crowd outside and eventually nodded towards a portly man in a three-piece suit with a mop of blonde hair falling across his forehead in a foppish style that wouldn't have looked out of place in a BBC period drama. I might have guessed, Ryan said, and shook her hand again. There must be more to this, he started to say again, but she interrupted him with another mild, knowing smile. I wasn't born yesterday. Moffa's on our radar and we'll be taking everything he says with a massive dose of salt. Ryan told himself to be content with that, for now. He thanked her and motioned Loesen in the direction of Moffa's solicitor, who was holding court with several prominent journalists, his rounded baritone projecting out into the night air as if he were on stage at the Royal Albert Hall and not a street corner in Newcastle city centre. It would be unwise for me to pass any comment at this stage of an active investigation, he said in a serious tone to be expected of legitimate legal counsel. Except to say that my client, James Moffa, has asked me to convey his sympathy to Detective Sergeant Frank Phillips, who he considers to be deeply unwell following the sad news of his girlfriend's abduction, which has been widely publicized. He, like all of us, wishes and prays for her safe return. He paused, to ensure they had made a good note of his soundbite. However, Mr. Moffa's sympathy does not extend to forgiving unprovoked attacks on his person and his staff, at his place of business. It is behavior unbecoming of a detective sergeant of experience and rank, and Mr. Moffa is fortunate not to have sustained more serious injuries. As it is, he is being driven directly to the hospital to have stitches. He held up both hands theatrically, fending off any more questions.
Really, that's all I can say. He began to walk towards his own chauffeured car, where Ryan was waiting with a sneer and a slow clap. Ever thought of changing profession? You deserve an Oscar after that little performance. Detective Ryan. Chief Inspector, he corrected. Whatever. Get out of my way. I'd like to ask you some questions. Here, or at your office, it makes no difference to me. The man started to reach for the door of the dark Audi, but Ryan put a restraining hand on his shoulder. Careful, Inspector, the solicitor warned him. You'll end up being sued alongside your mate. I want your name, Ryan ground out. Why? Do you think you'll be needing representation? The solicitor chuckled and produced a heavy green business card, thrusting it into Ryan's hand. A minute later, he and the car were gone, speeding off into the night. Loison stumbled through the crowd to where Ryan stood, tall and commanding amid the throng. Well? What did he say? The usual, he replied, tapping the card against his palm. But look at the name of his firm, Jack. Loison took the card and glanced down at the fancy gold embossed lettering on the front. What a coincidence that a notorious gangster and a prolific serial killer share the same firm of solicitors. What do I always say about coincidences, Jack? There's no such thing. Chapter 16. Edwards leaned back against the bonnet of his newly acquired car and watched the moon shining in the heavens. It dwarfed the people and houses far beneath who continued their ephemeral lives, watching television and talking about the latest celebrity gossip as if any of it mattered. He cast his eyes upward, past the cloudy ring of light pollution above the city, higher and higher, hoping that somebody would be watching him. Talk to me, he commanded, closing his eyes to blot out the sound of mankind, hoping that it would be replaced by something ethereal and beautiful. But, as always, there was a deafening silence. He opened his eyes and considered the sky again, resplendent with stars. Pegasus and Ursa Major dominated, and he was reminded of a time, long ago, when he had been gifted a telescope. What had been his most prized possession was forever lost to him now, hidden beneath the earth by years of dirt and overgrowth. He wouldn't think about that now. All those massive burning balls of gas were named after mythical gods to inspire awe in ordinary, simple-minded people. One day, his name might join theirs, alongside Hercules and Jupiter. The hacker would shine its fiery white light, and the people would stand in awe of it. They would speak of the man who had risen above ordinary men. He heard the rumble of an approaching vehicle and spotted the glimmer of headlights along the single-track lane. Quickly, he retrieved his rifle and melted into the shadow of a tree until he could see the car and its driver. When the familiar lines of a black Porsche Cayenne came into view, he lowered the rifle and merged back into the moonlight. Jimmy Moffa would have preferred an army of heavyweights to accompany him to meet a man like Edwards, but he was suffering a temporary staffing problem made worse by the fact that his right-hand man was taking a necessary leave of absence from the public eye. The young lad standing in his place looked the part, with a scar running across his neck and thick, gym-honed muscles after 6 years of boxing at one of the best rings in the city. However, Tony's scar came from a childhood fall, and he was yet to prove himself a fighter outside the ring, judging by his failure to put down Frank Phillips earlier. In the ordinary way of things, Tony would have been given his marching orders after that display. But good men were hard to come by, and he needed somebody he could mold into the kind of creature he wanted. One thing that could certainly be said of Tony was that he wasn't exactly the sharpest tool in the box, so he had high hopes that it wouldn't take too long to train him. "Door," he ordered. Tony jumped down from the driver's seat to open his master's door without needing to be told twice, and Moffa stepped down from the back seat of his car, motioning for his driver cum bodyguard to follow him. "You're late," Edwards remarked, resting the rifle in the crook of his arm. "You're a fugitive," Moffa replied, as his feet squelched in the mud underfoot. "Put the rifle on the floor." Edwards tapped his hand against the butt. "I don't want to get it dirty," he said. "Tony." The bodyguard nodded and reached into his breast pocket for a smaller handgun, which he held awkwardly in his sweaty palm. "Don't forget to take the safety off," Edwards advised him. Moffa's jaw hardened and the whites of his eyes gleamed. "You've caused quite a stir." "I'm nothing if not flamboyant," Edwards agreed. "What happened to your head?" Moffa swore viciously and stripped away the excess bandages, leaving only a small square surgical plaster to cover the butterfly stitches on his scalp. "Evasive measures," he explained. "I had an unexpected visit from Ryan's lapdog this evening." "Phillips?" Moffa inclined his head. "He wants to know where you are." Edward's face registered no emotion whatsoever, but his mind came to an immediate decision. If the police were on to Moffa, dominoes would start to fall, and it was too soon for that. There was no loyalty between them and nothing to secure his position other than the promise of money, which he was in no position to fulfill. It was a precarious situation, whichever way he looked at it. "What did you tell him?" Moffa laughed, and it was a rusty, grating sound. "I don't know nothing, gf," Moffa parodied. "That was my end of the bargain. Transportation, supplies and silence. In exchange, you would finish Ryan and provide full payment for services rendered, at a heavy discount, I might add." "You'll get your money," Edwards lied. "And Ryan will get his just deserts." "You're playing for time," Moffa rasped. "But you won't play me. Let me make myself perfectly clear, so we know where we stand. If you fail to provide the money within 3 days, I will tell the police all about your dirty, dirty little secrets. I'll tell them all about the real Ear Edwards. I'll tell them about the escape plan, and I'll say that you threatened to kill members of my family if I didn't help you. I'll tell them about your solicitor, all about how she passed messages between us. I will spill my guts and I'll have a steak dinner while they chuck you back in prison, love, but before then I'll ask Tony here to pay you a little visit, with my compliments." Edwards didn't like his tone. "No, not one little bit." He cast a cursory glance towards the man standing half a step behind Moffa, categorized him instantly as lightweight, and looked back at Moffa with a mocking smile. "I don't like it when we quarrel," he crooned, placing the rifle gently on the ground. He held both hands up, palms facing outward in a non-threatening gesture. Both men braced themselves as he moved towards them, his dark eyes twinkling like stars through the dusky evening. "That's far enough," Moffa snapped, but he found himself mesmerized. Edwards was an expert at reading certain types of behavior. He might not be able to empathize with his fellow man, but he could read them like a book, and this one had just become a lot more interesting. Jimmy Moffa, a hardened gangster feared by many, was hot under the collar. He was breathing quickly, his chest rising and falling beneath his tailored suit, and Edwards could almost smell the pheromones. If night hadn't fallen, he was sure there would be telltale signs of sexual attraction written all over his face. "Well, well," he murmured. "This is a delightful surprise." Tony watched the exchange with wide eyes and wondered whether he should have stepped in by now. Neither man said much, but there seemed to be plenty of conversation flowing in other ways, and the young man flushed with embarrassment and surprise. Moffat could only think that it was like being hypnotized by a snake. He had seen and done many things in his short life, few of which he could be proud of. He ran one-third of a growing criminal empire, but he would always be the youngest brother no matter how many times he proved himself. Faces of the men he had killed often haunted him at night, but they did not frighten him or fascinate him half as much as the man standing in front of him right now. With the possible exceptions of Ryan and Phillips, every other man he met was intimidated by his reputation. But not this one. Edwards stood in front of him without any pretense about the fact he was a murderer, a killer, an assassin. Equals. And it made him feel like a fumbling, rock-hard teenager again. A part of him wanted to roll the dice and see where they would fall, to play Russian roulette with his own life, if it meant having one taste of the utopia he could see with this man. "I said, that's far enough," he repeated, but even to his own ears his voice sounded weak. "Oh, I don't think so," Edwards purred. "Why don't we talk about it back at your place?" There was a short, tense silence before Moffat spoke again, and, when he did, his voice shook with excitement. "Tony, get the car started." Ryan and Lois found their friend sitting listlessly in the back of a squad car. The knuckles on his left hand were grazed and his right hand was completely bandaged up. There were a couple of small nicks and cuts on his face, and his shirt was speckled with blood that wasn't his own. In short, he looked awful. "Jack, do me a favor and grab us a couple of coffees, will you?" Lois and read the meaning in